Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is always a privilege to be able to speak to a man who has given considerable thought to and is really exercising tremendous influence on one of the most important battle spaces of that war, namely Asia. He is our regular featured contributor, Gordon Chang. We've caught up with him in Hong Kong, as it happens, and want to talk with him about some of the latest developments on the North Korea summit and related topics. Gordon Chang, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Oh, thank you so much, Frank.
You've written recently a couple of pieces that really caught my eye and that I'd like to have you drill down on for us, Gordon. One is the ominousness of the role being played in the run-up to this new rescheduled summit between Kim Jong-un, the dictator of North Korea, and President Trump, of a fellow by the name of Kim Yong-choi. Tell us about him and why that should give us pause.
Yeah, Kim Yong-chol is a senior envoy for Kim Jong-un. He went to the Oval Office on Friday. He was the former spy chief, as he's called, but he actually was more than that. He was the former chief of the Reconnaissance General Bureau, which was involved in spying, but also in many dirty acts. And this is a guy who has blood on his hands. Matter of fact, he's sanctioned by the U.S., and we needed to have a sanctions waiver in order to get him to travel to the U.S. to meet Secretary of State Pompeo in New York, and then, of course, President Trump in D.C. on Friday. And Kim brought a message, a letter to President Trump, which they displayed in their Oval Office meeting. I can sort of understand why President Trump had to meet him, but I'm not so sure that he had to meet him in the Oval Office or even in the White House. These pictures, I think, gave some legitimization to a very bad actor who was working, of course, for the world's worst regime.
Yeah, he's kind of the enforcer, I guess one might say, for that regime, and it does send an ominous signal indeed. And Gordon, do we have any sense of what the contents of this letter were and why the president seemingly feels further impelled to proceed with the legitimation, not simply of Kim's thuggish number two, I guess you might say, but with Kim Jong-un himself?
President Trump said that the contents of the letter were very positive, although I don't think the president actually read it. And I don't think that this letter contained what we needed to see, which was a commitment, clear commitment on the part of Kim Jong-un to dismantle the nuclear weapons program, ballistic missile program, and to give an accounting of the Japanese abductees. Got to remember that President Trump last month gave a promise, a very public promise, to Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to look after the abductee issue, to get an accounting. And I think the summit is probably going to proceed without getting those commitments. At least that's what it looks like at this moment. Hopefully there will be some developments between now and June 12th where the North Koreans will make those commitments. But as of now, we are on a track to a summit without getting what we need.
Now, Gordon, you've been writing extensively on these subjects and commenting on them for decades, but notably in your two books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. You've helped us understand the nature of the regimes we're up against. And I say regimes because, of course, China, as we'll be talking about elsewhere in the program today, is very much in this mix. But in terms of what may come out of a summit, describe, if you would, the concerns you've expressed that Kim may score big against Donald Trump. That's not how it's supposed to go down here, and the president has made it pretty clear he won't be party to that. And yet, you sort of are forecasting that that's how things are teeing up at the moment.
Yeah, the problem here is that there will be a summit. And as soon as that summit occurs, as soon as President Trump and Kim Jong-un are in the same room, we have given the North Koreans a big victory. That's legitimization of Kim Jong-un. Now, that's acceptable if we get from Kim what we need, which are commitments to give up their nukes and their missiles. And what's anomalous here, Frank, is that if we go back about 3 or 4 days ago, the North Koreans were the only side to make concessions, and they made two important ones. They released the three Americans early last month. They've also made pledges to denuclearize, quote unquote. And in the circumstances, it was clear that they were meaning giving up their weapons. Now we are giving them a victory, but we're not getting the commitments that they will actually make. And it wasn't really necessary for us to go through with this summit. We saw 2 Thursdays ago when the North Koreans were engaging in very belligerent comments. President Trump pulled the rug out from under them by saying he wasn't going to Singapore on the 12th. And then within hours, the North Koreans turned conciliatory, indicating that they realized that they had not only overplayed their hand, but they realized they were playing a weak hand. So we had all the momentum going. And if, from what we can tell right now, we've given it up for no gain at all. Now, maybe there's something happening in the background, but there's no indication of it from all we can see. And what's really disturbing, Frank, is that President Trump said, look, it may take more than one, two, and maybe even more than three summits to get the commitments from the North Koreans. That looks like a process, as they say, which just results in delay and giving the North Koreans all the benefits, and for us, none of them. So we've got to be all concerned that the administration is playing this incorrectly.
It's troubling indeed. I'm hoping, as I think you are, Gordon, that there's more than meets the eye at the moment. But the idea particularly that the President of the United States is going to be devoting the kind of time that might be suggested by that comment alone is worrying, let alone that it's doing so, it would seem, increasingly on Kim Jong-un's terms, a slow process and one that almost certainly means that there isn't going to be denuclearization of the irreversible and verifiable kind anytime soon. And that again, is ominous indeed. Gordon, just quickly, we're going to talk with several of our other guests here momentarily about some of these issues, too. And I'd just like to get your current reading on this. What role do you think China is playing in this process at the moment?
China is certainly up to no good. As we've seen over the last 3 months, their sanctions enforcement has markedly deteriorated. They're giving Kim Jong-un the confidence to defy the international community. And so we can look at China's role, as well as Russia and, to a lesser extent, South Korea, as ganging up on the United States.
Yeah. Russia being the other big swinger at the moment, of course, having sent the foreign minister of Russia into North Korea last week. Well, Gordon, I'm sure by the time you're back from Asia and we're reconnecting next week, we'll have a better reading on all of this in the immediate run-up to the summit. But at the moment, I take very much to heart your apprehension, which I must say I share. Thank you for doing it with our audience, Gordon. It's always good to talk with you, and safe travels, my friend. We'll talk with you next week. Next up, we'll visit with Claudia Rosette, who argues that only freedom can disarm Kim Jong-un. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by the inimitable Claudia Rosette, one of the country's great investigative journalists, a prize-winning columnist, as well as a great editorialist with the Wall Street Journal. These days, she writes at the PJ Media, her Rosette Report, a terrific blog, as well as serving as a foreign policy fellow with the Independent Women's Forum. She is always a welcome guest here, and Claudia, never more so now that we are trying to make sense of what is going on with this summit with Kim Jong-un. Welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be here.
You posted recently a very important essay, I think, about, well, the title of it says it all, doesn't it? Only Freedom Can Disarm Kim Jong-un. Tell us, what is the problem with trying to disarm him without doing something about his repressive police state regime and the threat it poses to his own people, arguably as well as ours?
Look, the basic problem here is the character of this Kim family regime in North Korea. It's a totalitarian system. That's not any exaggeration. It really is. It's a system that is both just barbaric in its cruelties toward its own people, is completely unscrupulous in its rule breaking around the world with its rackets and its assassinations and its kidnappings and so on. And this gives, it exalts the supreme leader, as they call or regard him, the Suryong is the Korean term for it, as the sort of absolute ruler of all.
A deity, in fact, no?
Yeah, pretty much. But exactly. That's how he has to be treated, on pain potentially of incredible suffering or death. And the people in North Korea under this scheme don't exist to be sort of happy citizens of a modern country. They exist to serve this ruler. And anyone who steps out of line can be sent with both parents, his or her parents and children, if any, to political prison camps that rival the gulag of Stalin for the way that people are starved, worked, tortured, executed, you know, basically ground down to death with no contact with the outside world. So that's the system we're talking about. And on human rights grounds alone, there's a good argument that this system really does need to go. It's, we know these things. They've been well documented over the years. But I'm not arguing this on human rights grounds. What I'm saying here is that this system also gives North Korea a very unsavory advantage in any deal that might be cut. The problem here being that when American leaders cut a deal, they are constrained, and a good thing it is, by American law and voters. And we have a hugely open, rollicking system full of checks on what the political leaders can do. And when they cut a deal, they are constrained to keep their word, to honor it. They have to deal with all sorts of criticism. They have to try and sell it at home. When Kim does that, or when his father did that, or his grandfather, there's no such constraint. Kim Jong-un can turn on a dime, on a yuan, and cheat, renegotiate the terms, say, I never agreed to that in the first place, I don't care, threaten us, refuse the things he's promised. No one at home has the power to seriously challenge that. He's up against certain constraints that reality itself will impose, and he's juggling, I believe, the patronage of Russia and China in these ventures. I mean, some people think he's disappointed and angered Russia and China. I don't think so. I think they're with him in this venture.
This raises several important questions. What is, in fact, as you see it, the role of China in all of this? Is it in China's interest and therefore something it is fostering, this threat to the West, specifically to the United States, but its allies as well, of course, South Korea and Japan, most especially, from Kim Jong-un, because it serves China's interests. And therefore, far from being a partner in ending this, you know, horror, we're seeing it do everything it can to perpetuate it, to prop it up, to ensure that it persists.
I think that's exactly the case. China's official line is that it doesn't want North Korea to have nuclear weapons. It's disappointed. It's upset. And China votes in favor of, has voted every UN Security Council resolution condemning and sanctioning North Korea, China has voted for. However, China cheats. Its own government is not as thoroughly sort of controlling as is North Korea's, but it's very bad. And it's a similar thing.
A lack of checks and balances.
Correct, Frank, exactly. And the behavior of China over decades has been such that, you know, it has not stopped North Korea from getting these weapons. On the contrary, a lot of the procurement channels have run through China. A lot of the financing has run through China. And things like some of these road mobile missile launchers that North Korea has acquired and parades came from China. You know, these are not small items to smuggle in. These are huge pieces of equipment.
Well, I want to come back to China in a moment, but just staying with North Korea, Claudia, when we hear Donald Trump talking, as he has of late, about the opportunities for North Korea to become a great and rich nation, and assuring Kim Jong-un that if he gave up his nuclear weapons, he would not be threatened by the United States, it sounds ominously to me as though he's really indicating he is prepared to perpetuate this regime without regard, it would appear, for the kinds of concerns you've expressed, but more to the point, with a willingness to turn a blind eye to what that regime actually is doing to its own people, and I argue, therefore, conceivably could be willing to do to us.
It's been hard to avoid that conclusion, Frank, and it's a disturbing one. I mean, it's the factors I keep trying to figure out are, there is now Ambassador John Bolton as National Security Advisor. I know from things he's said and written for years that he is wise to North Korea's games. The Center for Security's Policy's own Fred Flights is now working with the National Security Council with John Bolton. I know that he understands this scene very well. So there's certainly advice available right inside the White House on just how completely North Korea is likely to try to game this whole scene, and I think is already well on the way to doing it. This was why I wrote, the first condition needs to be the dismantling of the totalitarian controls of the regime. Then you have some voice potentially coming from North Korea that counters the sort of predatory ambitions of the Kim family regime. You have some voice that says, hey, wait a minute, North Koreans actually would like better lives, because I don't think Kim is terribly concerned with that. This is a man who, to keep power, had his half-brother assassinated with VX nerve agent, who runs these horrible political prison camps. And that's exactly why I was saying, on sort of strategic grounds alone, you need to have a dismantling of the totalitarian controls before you have a prayer of verification, monitoring, or any kind of good faith, or that incentives such as economic prosperity, not just for Kim and his ruling cronies and his nuclear program and military, but for those people in North Korea who have no electrical power.
To really address the threat. Yeah, this is a bare minimum of what needs to be done. It seems not to be in prospect, alas, at the moment. Let me turn to one other piece of this, though, Claudia. We touched on China a moment ago. I spoke with you, I think, after you filed your report about the first hearing of the House Intelligence Committee about the looming decade of concern, as Jim Fennell described it, a Navy captain now retired, but expert in these matters. The threat that seems to be burgeoning by the day, I think, is the only way one can describe it in terms of China, in terms of its ability to project power through bases and choke points and man-made islands and the like now worldwide, and its growing military power, has to be of concern to us all. And yet, it seems as though there remains sort of this influence operation, perhaps, or at least a predisposition on the part of a lot of businesses and a lot of people in government to turn a blind eye towards it all. We'll be talking more about this with Matt Continetti in a moment, but I would like your thoughts on how persistent that problem is and what we have to do about it if we're to contend properly with this threat from China.
Yeah, particularly appropriate to talk about this as the 29th anniversary rolls around of the June 4th crushing of the Tiananmen uprising in 1989, because the problem, again, is the character of the Chinese regime. I think China, in choosing a direction, and I'm not talking about the people of China, I don't think they've had a choice in more than half a century, as far as they ever did, is not heading now in the direction of a rising, friendly merchant power that wants to be part of the sort of peaceful world of civilized dealings. They now have a president for life, Xi Jinping. They have a plan, as Captain Pinnell outline in his testimony to the House Intelligence Committee, for China to become the dominant world power by the 100th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic, which will be 2049. And you can see a lot of this going on. They're playing a long game, and we rob, we operate. It's a great advantage in many ways for us, but it is not, again, in this realm, on 4 to 8 year cycles of presidents. And the single thing I think is most important here, Frank, is America needs to rebuild its military massively. You know, a Reagan-style naval rebuild-up. I think a lot of the soft power measures that are coming into play might have some effect, but sanctions, the trade standoffs and so on, which are economically kind of dangerous for us as well as for China.
Claudia Rosette, again, I couldn't agree with you more, and I couldn't be more pleased that you've just expressed it so elegantly, as you always do. Thank you for joining us today, and I hope you'll come back to us again in the run-up to the summit, as well as in its immediate aftermath in the days ahead. Thanks so much for your time today. Next up, Matt Continetti joins us from the Washington Free Beacon on the China problem as he sees it, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by Matthew Continetti. He is the editor-in-chief of a superb media outlet in Washington, the Washington Free Beacon. He has also served as the opinion editor and remains a contributor to the Weekly Standard. He is the author of two important books, The K Street Gang, The Rise and Fall of the Republican Machine, and The Persecution of Sarah Palin, How the Elite Media Tried to Bring Down a Rising Star. Well, speaking of rising stars, you are one. Matthew Continetti, thank you so much for taking some time to join us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
Well, listen, I thought we might start with the subject du jour, as it is many days here at Secure Freedom Radio, which is China and what it is up to. You wrote an important piece last week simply titled The China Problem. Would you walk us through the pieces of that problem, as you see it, that ought to concern all of us?
Well, I call it the China problem because when we look at some of the most important national security and even economic security issues related to the United States, they all trace back to China's growing power. And I wrote the piece in the context of the on-again, off-again, now it's on-again summit in Singapore between North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un and President Trump. And what I was trying to communicate to the administration, as well as just to a general audience, was that North Korea can't be seen in isolation. It really is a vassal in some ways, certainly in a small ally in others of China. And the real problem, it seems to me, is China and its authoritarian regime and its growing bellicosity, and both in terms of economics and in terms of security.
I couldn't agree more with that, and it's kind of mystifying that it has been so poorly understood. Indeed, Matt, as you know so well, for I guess really decades now, we've been fed this line that actually China is our partner in trying to constrain this North Korean thugocracy. And if only we do enough to, well, appease China, they will help us mitigate that problem, if not make it go away. Here we are on the eve of these negotiations, as you say. Does there seem to be any basis for this notion, which unfortunately does still linger in some quarters, at least?
Of China being a partner? I don't believe so. And I think more of Washington is becoming aware of China's adversarial relation to the United States. And I really have to credit President Trump with that. You know, he often kind of gives himself credit for saying that he was talking about issues that no one else was talking about. In the case of China, he certainly was the only Republican candidate who made China an issue. Now, he tends to stress the economic consequences of our trade deficit with China, and I do believe there have been detrimental consequences to that trade relationship. But even the trade relationship needs to be seen in a broader context of China's growing power in the Pacific, in the South China Sea, And now we're getting to the point where China is using that growing economic and military power to interfere in the culture and the operations of other countries, including Australia, even to some extent the United States. The term for it is sharp power. And China has been wielding this sharp power against our friends and against ourselves. And it's only now that President Trump and I believe more and more members of the United States Congress are taking notice and trying to fight back.
Yeah. You've published at the Washington Free Beacon just today an important piece by Bill Gertz, which describes some of that sentiment as it's being expressed particularly on Capitol Hill at the moment with respect to the influence operations that the Chinese are mounting right here in the United States, as you say. It's not just Australia or other countries. It's here on our college campuses. It's here in Hollywood. It's here in, you know, people who are being silenced as they report for publications that the Chinese take a stake in and shut down. Give us a sort of your sense of how this sort of countervailing pressure is likely to net out if we are beginning to get a greater awareness, long overdue, but nonetheless get a greater awareness of the problem. Is it meaningfully being suppressed or suborned, maybe, by what the Chinese influence operators are doing?
Well, I think one takeaway is that there's a bipartisan consensus that's emerging. And so when you look at the bill that Bill Gertz writes about at freebeacon.com, that's sponsored by Republican Chris Smith, as well as Democrat Marcy Kaptur of Ohio. Some of the president trade actions on China have been applauded by Democrats, such as Sherrod Brown of Ohio and even Chuck Schumer.
Nancy Pelosi, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, of course, you know, it's funny, Frank, we forget that back when we were debating giving China our most favored nation status and allowing China to enter the WTO, one of the opponents of that was Nancy Pelosi, who found herself in alliance with a lot of religious conservatives and even the neoconservatives. So that type of bipartisan alliance, I think, is beginning to emerge once more. And that gives me hope. I have to say, though, you know, there's such a lack of confidence in America from large swaths of our elites that's what worries me. And that is, you know, you often hear, well, why do we have to do the apologizing and China's just a growing power and that's just, we have to make ourselves comfortable with that. I think that's a temptation and one that needs to be opposed, because really the conflict for the next, you know, several decades is not going to be the United States and North Korea. It's going to be between the United States and China for dominion over the Indo-Pacific region.
Right, and possibly far beyond. One of the featured characters in that elite, at least in the previous administration, was Ben Rhodes, the Deputy National Security Advisor to President Obama. He has a new book coming out called The World as It Is that you reviewed a bit of in one of your recent columns, Matt Continetti, at the Washington Free Beacon. And I'd like to get your thoughts on the role that Ben Rhodes played during the Obama years and that he seems to be playing for President Obama in his post-president role.
That's right. Well, we know it from Ben Rhodes himself. He granted an interview to David Samuels in the New York Times Magazine a few years ago, where he said that really he created an echo chamber, his words, to advance the Iran deal and to basically target and isolate and discredit critics of the Iran deal while President Obama was in office. And I do think we even see that echo chamber at work today. And when you look at John Bolton's recently appointed chief of staff at the National Security Council, Fred Flights, someone we all know and are friends with, he has been the target of just outrageous smears since his appointment. And I wouldn't be surprised if you traced back the sourcing of those articles, you would find the same echo chamber that went after Barack Obama's critics when he was in office. Ben Rhodes, he's something out of a novel, and he would know because really his only degree is in creative writing.
What he aspired to be was a novelist, as I recall.
A novelist, yeah. And he ended up, of course, I wish he had been successful as a novelist, because instead he ended up as Deputy National Security Advisor.
Well, it was writing fiction of a different kind, though. It turned into national policy, which he helped sell to you know, a public that was generally ill-disposed.
Yeah, he might not have been the author of the policy, but he was certainly the publicist of the policy that I think left America incredibly weak. We still find out just the extent of that weakness that Obama gave us today.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned Fred Flights, of course, as one of my colleagues at the Center for Security Policy. We have found ourselves at the receiving end of a lot of that attack, as Fred has been for being our senior vice president for a number of years. And it is striking that he was both during the Obama years and subsequently one of the most effective critics of what the president was doing, what Ben Rhodes was doing, what the Iranians were getting away with. And I think unquestionably there's some element of payback by Rhodes and his echoists, as you say, Matt Continetti, because this policy approach that was so at odds with the sellout of what I call the Obama bomb deal has now become the policy of the president of the United States. And I'm sure that they are fit rot over the fact that this legacy piece has gone over the side. Adam Credo, I do want to say a special thank you to him as well as Bill Gertz, two of your terrific writers on these national security pieces, did a very, very commendable job of setting the record straight about Fred and holding accountable some of these characters. And I just want to say thank you more generally, Matt, for the work that the Free Beacon is doing, because I think really it's one of those indispensable institutions in Washington for getting the facts out and making sure that people who would distort them or suppress them or otherwise manipulate them, as Ben Rhodes has confessed to doing, are held accountable for it. So I want to just say a word of thanks on that score as well.
Thank you, Frank. I appreciate it.
Let me just close by saying, Matt Continetti, as you are making book on this summit with Kim Jong-un, knowing the role that China is playing, do you share the concern that I must say I have and Claudia Rosette expressed very articulately, that if we don't address fundamentally what's most wrong and dangerous about this North Korean regime, that we're likely to get not much out of this except the legitimation of Kim Jong-un, namely, you know, changing the character of the regime itself?
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting. President Trump deals in personalities and individuals. He doesn't really deal in institutions or even states. So I think part of this is him trying to meet Kim Jong-un himself so he can get a personal sense of Kim, and maybe kind of a psychological understanding of where the relationship can go. Everything we've heard from the president is that he is going to insist on the complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization of North Korea, and I don't think that the North Koreans are there quite yet.
We'll be watching it closely, as will you, and we look forward to reading and talking further with you about all this, Matt. Thanks so much for your time today. Next up, Luke Rosiak joins us right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Luke Rosiak, who writes these days for The Daily Caller, where he is an investigative reporter. He has done what in a just world would be Pulitzer Prize-winning research into a scandal that is of simply, well, stunning magnitude in terms of the history of the United States Congress, and yet has, really, but for his own work, hardly gotten any attention at all. It involves the administration of quite a number of House Democrats' official information technology services by Pakistani expats, a family of them, and some of their associates. And it is a delight to have Luke Rosiak back with us to talk about this scandal, what we have learned to date, and what seems to be still going unaddressed properly by investigators, as well as by the Congress itself. Luke, it is so good to have you back. Thank you for joining us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
So just to recap quickly, and there's so much that you have uncovered with your intrepid investigative reporting over the past year, year and a half, whatever it's been. Give us kind of the highlights of this scandal as you see them.
What happened is there was a second hack during the 2016 election that no one knows about because it was completely covered up. And on the same day that the DNC, that WikiLeaks started publishing those DNC emails, the House Inspector General briefed House of Representatives officials on a second cyber infiltration. This one by Pakistani nationals who were hired as IT guys and were working for so many Democrats on Capitol Hill that they had access to all the emails and files of 1 in 5 Congress members. So you might think, obviously, if this happened at the height of the election, this would be a huge thing. We'd all be talking about it. No, the reason we don't know about it is because it was covered up. Not only that, but Democrats jeopardized national security by making the decision to leave these guys on the network and to knowingly allow the United States to be continuously hacked from July of 2016 through Trump's inauguration because they wanted to keep this out of the media and not be an issue during the election. And if they would have arrested these guys, if they would have had the typical response to a hack, an urgent response, SWAT teams coming in, it would be big headlines. And then you've got this, you know, this is right at the time that they're trying to form the Russian narrative in the media using CrowdStrike, Fusion GPS, all that stuff. The revelation of a second hack during the height of the 2016 election would have made it very difficult to pitch a concise and compelling Russian narrative to the public, which is what the Democrats' goal was in 2016. I mean, remember Wasserman Schultz at the DNC, they didn't even give the server over to the cops, which made it pretty impossible to hold these guys accountable in court of law. What their goal was to make this whole narrative about Russia where you get everyone riled up and you get a common external enemy, and the existence of a second hack by Pakistanis that were hired by Democrats, and it would have made it very difficult to create that narrative. Not only that, but it would have been very embarrassing for the Democrats because they were jumping down Donald Trump's throat at that time for talking about the need to vet Muslims, and here these guys were literally unvetted Muslims because the House policy said that you got to give background checks. They exempted them all from background checks even though they had criminal backgrounds. They had Pakistani citizenship, dozens of over a dozen LLCs that they created, just massive, massive red flags in their background. And the Democrats basically ushered the wolf into the hen house, and it really blew up on them.
And kept them there. Well, I mean, it blew up on them in the sense that it went really bad. Their emails, their official correspondence, their office calendars and all kinds of things were presumably accessed and made available to others by these so-called IT administrators out of Pakistan. Look, one of the things that I'd like to just tie in here, if I could, is your reporting has suggested, and I don't know if you've drawn a final conclusion on this yet or not, but it is suggested that the degree to which these IT guys had access to Debbie Wasserman Schultz's passwords may have made it possible for them to have had access to the very Democratic National Committee servers that were allegedly hacked by the Russians, though we're not actually given any evidence that that happened. But talk us through the possible nexus there, would you?
Well, I think it's certainly possible that Imran Awan also had something to do with that DNC hack. If you search his name in WikiLeaks, the DNC officials were on a first-name basis with him. He was the only one who had Debbie Wasserman Schultz's password, and they would just summon him when they needed to log into her devices. But Wasserman Schultz has really defended him in a way that is inexplicable. So what you have is the Inspector General of the House of Representatives, who is a Democratic appointee selected by Nancy Pelosi and just a tremendous cybersecurity expert. Her background is entirely in cybersecurity. She started raising, kind of blowing the whistle and raising red flags right around July of 2016, and the Democrats blocked her from investigating. And Wasserman Schultz herself was kind of like threatening investigators and trying to shut the whole thing down.
Yeah, the Capitol Police chief, as I recall.
Exactly. There's that video where you can see the kind of the emotion on her face, and she's screaming, you know, she's threatening the Capitol Police chief with consequences for investigating this hack. That doesn't make any sense for Wasserman Schultz, who had just recently lost her job because of her failure to respond, among other things, to the hack at the DNC. So the relationship between Wasserman Schultz and Imran Awan is suggestive that she is so frightened about something that looking into the sky would reveal. And so that's kind of what we've seen, is that the intense aversion to investigating this, despite an IG report dated September 20th and then a second one dated September 30th of 2016 that spell out in no uncertain terms that the House of Representatives was hacked by this guy, including logging into the House Democratic Caucus server, which it sounds kind of like the sister, it sounds similar to the DNC, right? I mean, that's because for all... it's essentially the sister group. It's very similar. So right at the same time, we have the DCCC, the DNC, and the House Democratic Caucus all being hacked. And we've caught one of these guys. It's Imran Awan. The server logs show it. And now here we are 2 years later, and he hasn't been charged. And the Democrats are, you know, trying to sow a lot of uncertainty around all this. But that's the great thing about computers is it's a binary. When computer logs show something, there's not really any subjectivity to it. The server logs show unauthorized access by Imran Awan.
So why are we still here? Where is the investigation? I have to say, it sounds increasingly as though it's kind of a Keystone Cops investigation, if I can use that term, now involving not just the Capitol Police, but other law enforcement agencies, including the FBI. There's been a lack of a prosecution of these guys. The court dates have been repeatedly rescheduled. I gather there's another one scheduled for tomorrow, the 7th. What's going on with the law enforcement community? Why aren't they taking this seriously? At the very least, it seems from what you've reported that we've got, at the very minimum, criminal activity in huge quantities and possibly counterintelligence problems as well.
And that's the most disturbing part of this to me, is that we not only have Democrats jeopardizing national security by leaving suspected hackers on the network from July of 2016 through Trump's inauguration, we have the DOJ and the FBI, including under the Trump administration, carrying water for Democrats. And you've got those deep state FBI and DOJ agents who are not being honest with Jeff Sessions, and the message isn't getting up to the right people. And they're saying, you know, well, there's nothing there. There is no shortage of undisputable criminal charges that are ready to go against these guys. You know, you get into the hacking, that's obviously should be a big and complicated case, but they haven't even been charged with the simple stuff that there's no doubt that they did, like hiding their dozen plus LLCs on their sworn congressional ethics disclosures, including their supposed used car dealership that took $100,000 from a Hezbollah-linked fugitive. So the FBI has been, it really started with the House. The House didn't even get the cops involved for a couple months, from July until September. And then what they did is they used the Capitol Police instead of the FBI, because it's more, they can control it because it's part of the legislative branch. And what they did is they took the investigation away from a cybersecurity expert, the House IG, and gave them to these kind of cops that don't have any cybersecurity expertise. Eventually, the FBI did get involved, but they allowed the suspects to leave the country multiple times. They are now, prosecutors are supposedly negotiating with this guy, even though one of the stories I did last week found that he's still engaging in apparent misconduct.
Luke, thank you so much for the work that you've been doing on this at the Daily Caller. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Affney.